Buckle up and settle in for a full hour of automotive mayhem with the real car guy, master technician, Mark Salem, where the only two things we can't fix is a broken heart and the crack of dawn. To talk to Mark, call 602-508-0960. That's 602-508-0960. Now, once again, here's Mark. Rolled up to my Chevrolet,
I climbed out up inside. Welcome back, everybody. Well, not really welcome back, but 4 minutes after the hour, 10 o'clock, and for the next 2 hours, we're going to talk about car repair. We're going to talk about, which one is he on?
I think I should be on three.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, three.
Three. There's you.
So turn two and four off.
Okay. We're done.
No, you just turned two and three off.
Oh.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, no. My gosh.
Turn two off now.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay.
All right. Now.
You know, if you numbered those, I'd
yeah. See the bottom right there?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are numbers.
Okay. All right. You know.
On your little label.
You're starting bad again. You're starting bad. Last week I had your mother, and today is, oh, boy. Okay. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. We're here every Saturday for 2 hours talking about your car repair. But let me tell you real quick about Action Auto. Action Auto is located at I-17 in Deer Valley. It's a full-service, family-owned operation. It's been serving the Deer Valley and the North Phoenix area since 1983. Tom, the owner, is a great guy. He's the kind of guy you'd hope lived next door to you. He's a straight arrow. He's the kind of guy that, you know, talks straight. He's not a bragger. He's not any of that. But he is a great fisherman, I'll tell you. Their technicians at Action Auto are ASC Master Certified. That means they're going to diagnose it right, fix it right, and then go verify the fix actually fixed your problem. So if you live anywhere near I-17 in Deer Valley and you don't have a repair shop, may I suggest that you stop by Action Auto, northwest corner of I-17 and Deer Valley. Make an appointment for an oil change and see how you like them. And that's an easy way to find out. Okay, we want to talk real quick. There's a lot of customers of ours that listen to our show,
mm-hmm.
and we want to tell them that we just bought a new ice machine for our soda pop dispenser in our lobby.
Okay.
And the ice machine is quite a bit bigger than we ever expected. We could leave the door open, and we could put a foot worth of ice in two bays, and it's huge. So this is the time that people are heading to the lake. So if you're one of our customers, you know where Salem Boys Auto is already at. Friday afternoon, you're heading to the lake. Thursday, you're going north. Stop by, bring your ice chest, and we'll fill it up with ice for free. All you have to do is be a customer. So, and we already have people that do that to some extent anyway.
Right.
So, anyway, you can call us first, but I don't think we've ever run out of ice on a Friday afternoon.
No.
So, we have lots of ice, and you're more than welcome. We actually service the Tempe area, the Chandler area, the Gilbert area, and the Ahwatukee Mountain Park Ranch area. That's kind of our area. In Tempe, northeast is Schumann's Auto and IMM Auto. So between the two of us, we got Tempe covered. I'm kind of west and south, and they're kind of north and east. And we've got facilities in every other part of the city of Phoenix. So I got a call from a guy, and he said to me, last week you hit my problems nail on the right on the head. He said, you were talking about engine mounts, and you were talking about the different symptoms of engine mounts. So you have a vibration in drive that goes away in neutral or goes away in reverse. He says you have sometimes a thunk when you give it a hard acceleration. And he said, I had this particular problem that I could not diagnose. And he says, and then when I heard you talking about that, he said, I then had my son check it out, and that the right side motor mount, which is what we call the load mount, it's on the passenger side, because the motor, when you throttle up hard, the motor turns clockwise and it lays down on that right side of the motor pretty hard. He said that it lost all of its oil and it was grounded, which is a word that we use. So he said that fixed it. He said actually he had both front ones replaced and that fixed it.
Right.
That gives people kind of a false sense of security, the ability for us to fix their cars over the phone. You have to have two things to even get close to a car repair. And what are they?
Symptoms.
And they have to be good symptoms.
Yeah, good symptoms, accurate.
And they have to be accurate. And then you have to have somebody on the other end of the phone that knows about cars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I qualify for that. If anybody does, I do.
Right.
Which brings me to the point of there's a lot of these these, what do you call them? It's kind of a communication.
Big brother.
Yeah, big brother is exactly what most people call them. It's a communication between you and the car maker through your entertainment system.
Right.
So General Motors, everybody recognizes OnStar, mm-hmm. which is General Motors. Blue Link is Hyundai. Then Ford is called Sync. And then Chrysler is called Uconnect. And what this is, folks, is your car has the ability to be on the internet. And what you do is you sign up for these, and that opens the door for them to communicate to you. Now, I'm going to tell you right up front that I don't like this for two basic reasons. Number one, I don't like this is because they are marketing to you, and they're trying to get you to deal with them, which kind of takes me out of the equation. So I'm a little selfish about that. Number two, they are creating the perception that this person on the phone is going to be able to diagnose your problem. And they are no more capable of diagnosing your problem than the young three-whiskered kid at AutoZone or O'Reilly's or anybody else. You better know what you're talking about. And in addition to all these codes that cars have, there is a significant amount of manual labor that goes on. For instance, there is nothing in your car that tells anybody at any time what your fuel pressure is. And we run into problems all the time that are directly related to fuel pressure. Your car should have 50 and it has 31. Now, there's nothing the guy or the lady in the cloud's going to be able to look at your car and determine fuel pressure. And that creates a problem because what they're going to do is say, hey, well, there's a dealer right around the corner, and if you'll stop by there, they'll take a look at it. Typically, taking a look at it is, in my world, no less than $80 and upwards to $150, $175.
Right.
I know we quote $85 to $125.
Mm-hmm.
So the least amount you're going to spend for quote-unquote diagnostic time, DIAG, is 85, and the most you're going to call, and we're going to stop at 125 and call you if we need more than that.
Right.
So these kinds of communications through your entertainment system, you have to know what they're capable of. In addition to that, they'll tell you that when you have an accident and the airbag deploys, that someone knows that, and that's true. That person's going to come on and say, hey, Mark, are you okay? Do you really think I care that somebody's talking to me over the radio if the airbag just hit me in the face at 100 miles an hour and I've got steam and coolant and oil and I got people screaming and all that kind of stuff? Do you really think that I need somebody that's clear across the world to call the 911 in my immediate area to tell them that there's been a car wreck? Or perhaps all the other hundreds of people with cell phone that just saw the collision occur? So we have to look at this from a pragmatic point of view. We have to look at it from how is this really going to benefit you? Here's how there is a good thing about this connection. They know where your car's at unless, of course, I steal it. And I'm going to disable their ability to know where I'm at. They can also, under certain circumstances, bring the car to a stop by shutting the engine off. But again, I can disable that.
They have to know where it's at in order to do that, or they have to be able to track it. And if we pull the fuse, then...
We're not going to tell them how to do it, but there's two things you have to do. Pulling the fuse is one of them.
Right.
So we can bad guys can disable it, and we're not telling you anything the bad guys don't already know.
Right.
So you disable the ability for the car to have GPS. You disable the ability for the car to talk to the cloud. And therefore, the guy in the cloud, and under normal conditions, the police department can contact, well, let's just use OnStar, for example. And OnStar can say, okay, well, here's the car, and the police get behind you. And then the police say, okay, OnStar, it now is a good time to shut the engine off, turn on the hazards. Well, if you shut the engine off at 55 or 75 or 85 miles an hour, the clown behind the wheel doesn't have power brakes, doesn't have power steering anymore. There's a risk associated with that. If he decides to cross over into oncoming traffic and take two innocent people out, that's ugly.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to kind of bring him down slowly until 25, 15 miles an hour, then shut the car off, turn on the flashers, and then the police surround him and arrest him. The problem with that is that many of these OnStar, Blue Link, Sync, and Uconnect, you virtually need an order from the court to get them to do anything, because we're not that deep into this relationship. So there's lots of police officers.
And that's based on privacy concerns, correct?
It's only one of them, but you're right. It's a privacy concern. It's kind of like you want to serve a search warrant on Mark Salem's house. You have to prove to me that you have valid reason to do that. And how do we know that you belong to the New Jersey State Police? You have to prove that to us. Then you have to prove to us that this person is actually wanted or this car is actually stolen. Well, at 100 miles an hour, this conversation can cover 100 miles because it's going to take an hour to give them all that. So those are the kinds of issues. Now, there is one last thing, and this is where they hack your car. And so they're going to go in, and if your phone is connected to the entertainment system, and if your phone has your credit cards and your personal stuff in it, we're already feeding the phone information to your entertainment system because we're listening to the music that's on your phone. And when you talk on the phone, you usually use the entertainment to do that. So now all of a sudden, they can hack your car and they can gather information off of your phone that's in your purse that's only wirelessly connected to your car, because once they gain access to that, the phone's already open and has already let your entertainment system has already let the phone come in, so the entertainment system doesn't have to put in a code, which is your entry
passcode,
thank you. So that creates a whole different issue. Now, I know how I can make your brakes fail. If I was a hacker, I know exactly what I could do and what bad information I could feed the computer on your car to make it where you hit the brakes and the pedal goes to the floor. So if I know it, so does a whole lot of bad people. And many of you have seen on television where the couple of ladies are driving around in a big old parking lot. There's a guy with a laptop, and I don't remember what channel it is, but it's one of the big ones, NBC, ABC, CBS. They're driving around, and this guy's typing on his computer. He pushes a button. They instruct the ladies to hit the brakes, and the pedal goes to the floor. The ladies have no brakes whatsoever. So obviously, that's going to create a problem as well. So we have to get past all of that. So make your decision based on what's best for you. And obviously, if you're a grandmother and you drive long distances, you might get comfort in them knowing where you're at. That might be your cause. That's okay. I mean, I don't care. You're the one that's paying the bill. But then there's other people who have privacy concerns, and that could very easily be it. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. And when we come back, we're going to tell you about an Audi we had this week that was the most unusual thing we've ever seen in all of our lives with respect to a car and the computer and how that talk is actually happening. So we'll be back right after this. And we'll bring that back up here, and then everybody will be happy. Mark Salem and Alan Salem sitting here at your service. Alan handles the performance side of our business, and I handle the mechanical side along with my daughter, Andy. And so we're here to help you if you have a car question. And actually what works really well is this year, make, and model. Tell us how many miles it's got on it, and then just give us the symptoms. And that helps us out a lot to at least start the conversation. What doesn't help us out is when you start off with telling us the 42 parts you've replaced. And that really, it doesn't make any difference, because if you still have the problem, then the only conclusion you could come with is that it's not one of those 42 parts or the connection or something like that was bad. And speaking of bad, you need to stop saying that. Stop talking like that. Anyway, this portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Air Park Auto Service. Nadine and Stacy opened up Air Park Auto Service in North Scottsdale in 1985. This is on Raintree, just east of Hayden. Back then, there was a whole lot of jackrabbits up there, but now, as you well know, if you live up in that area, there's no jackrabbits left. Air Park Auto is a state-of-the-art, clean and green facility. They have the latest diagnostic tools and service that most makes and models of cars and trucks can talk to, so they can talk to those. So if you live in the North Scottsdale area and you don't already have a shop, I know you'll be happy with the service you receive at Air Park Auto. All right, the Audi. You start with the symptoms. The guy brings the car in, and what does he say?
Actually, he didn't bring the car in. He called me. It's a good buddy of mine.
Okay.
And he said that car said to add a quart of oil on the message system. Add oil, add half quart of oil. So he took it and had an oil change.
Okay.
And as soon as he left, it said the message was still there. Add a half a quart of oil. And he looked on the paperwork. He talked to the people. He looked up the capacity, and he knows that it was filled up properly. And he doesn't understand why it still said that it was low.
Okay.
To add a half a quart.
So he added some more.
Yeah. So he added an extra half a quart or a quart or something like that.
And then Eddie said he added a couple of times because it kept saying, add a quart, add a quart. So he'd open up the hood and he'd add a quart.
Yes.
Now, this is a car that doesn't really have a dipstick. It has a dipstick tube, but there's no dipstick in the dipstick tube.
That is right. No
dipstick. You
have dipstick.
To buy it. Now, Audis aren't cheap, but they make you buy a dipstick so you can properly check your oil.
That's right.
Okay. So, folks, this is how the computer works. He clearly was something low on oil. So it has a level sensor somewhere in the engine, somewhere in the oil pan, and it knows where the oil level is. So it turns on the light and says, hey, you're a half a quart low. First of all, no one should care when you're a half a quart low because that means the oil level is between the add and the full mark.
Right.
So that's an acceptable time.
Right.
That's an acceptable area. So the car says it's half full or it's half a quart low. Here's what he didn't know. The computer in the car expects the hood to open and close. And when it does it, the car stops telling you that it's a half a quart.
Yeah, periodically, after a certain number of miles, it wants you to check the oil. I don't know what that mileage is, but it wants to see, I say check the oil, but you can't really check the oil because there is no dipstick. But it wants you to open up the hood and stare at the hood for 5 minutes.
And it wants you to add oil in the tube, a half a quart.
Because it's thinking, okay, it's been 3,000 miles since this guy's popped his hood, and normal oil usage is this, so it just kind of recommends adding a half a quart. Yeah,
So the owner of the car, whoever, Jack in the Box, opens the hood, and they assume because you open the hood, you added a half a quart, then you shut the hood.
Right.
So some period of time later, it sees that the oil level hasn't changed.
Right.
So it tells you to open the hood again.
Right.
And this went on 3 or 4 or 5 times with your buddy.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's what the problem was. This is craziness. The problem was, is the switch on the hood that would tell the computer the hood was open was bad. And so every time you opened the hood and checked the oil and added oil to it and shut the hood, the computer never knew that happened because the switch is bad. So this went on until he overfilled the engine. Then he brought it into us. We drained the oil. We put the right amount of oil in it. We actually bought a dipstick. Then we plugged in our computer-to-computer language, and we say, hey, what the hell are you doing? And it says, well, nobody's opened the hood. And we said, okay. And then we go into the hood, and we open the hood, and it doesn't say the hood is open. We shut the hood, and it doesn't say the hood is shut. It doesn't know where the hood is. So we take the connector, the wire connector off, and we short it. So we close this connection. That means it's closed. When we open the connection, it opens. So we artificially send it the right signal, and pretty soon it says, oh, I see the hood open, and oh, I see the hood closed.
Yep.
So this is where gray-haired guys come in. Eddie, who's been with us, God knows.
28 years.
28 years. He takes the switch off, and he looks at it, and he says, I don't have anything to lose by taking this switch apart.
And actually, we think it was the car had been recently purchased, and it had been sprayed with that Schleiden stuff all over the place. And we think it had got into that little contact point of the hood switch, micro switch.
Okay. So Eddie takes it apart and finds the contacts dirty. He cleans the contacts. He puts it all back together. He puts it back on the hood, and he figures out pretty doggone quick that the computer can now see the hood open and close.
Mm-hmm.
So he also sells the guy a dipstick. That's the difference between the young guys and the old guys. I feel pretty doggone confident that the time to take the switch off, take it apart, and clean it was one-third the price of take the old one off, buy a new one, install the new one. I am quite sure it's
a third of the price all the oil that he didn't need that he overfilled.
How bad did you tease him about that?
Not bad. He's a good friend of mine.
Okay. But you did tease him.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, so, you know, it really is kind of funny because the car keeps telling you to add a half a quart of oil. He keeps adding a half a quart of oil, and sooner or later he's thinking to his car, what's the matter with you? Are you an idiot?
Yeah.
I keep adding oil.
Yeah.
So when you see oil coming out of the tailpipe, that's when you got to stop.
Yeah. When you have to wait for it to burp under the valve cover, you know you have got too much oil in it.
What he means is when you add to the oil in the valve cover is now full, and so you shake the car with, you know, with your body, and then you burp the oil out of it, and then you add more oil. Well, by that time, it's 40 times fuller than it ought to be.
Right, no, I know.
So I know that's a good visual, though. That's a good, you know, you're creating a visual that people can understand. So that's how sophisticated the cars are. But we're not scared of that because we understand how they work.
1 minute.
We understand that the computer is keeping track of the hood. So all we have to do is find the stupid switch or the wires that go to the switch, and then we can fake it out. So you disconnect, you take the switch off the hood, and Alan's inside, and I rotate the switch this way, and you say, it's open.
Yep.
I rotate the switch this way, and you say it's closed.
Yep.
Well, we know the switch works.
Yep.
In this case, we did that, and the computer said, I don't see the switch.
Yeah. And you know what's funny is we'll probably see this problem in the next 5 years. We'll probably see it 100 times.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just beginning. This is just the first time.
And then we're also going to see it. They're going to blow an upper radiator hose. The whole underside of the hood's going to have coolant in it. It's going to wipe out that switch. And pretty soon, about 40 years from now, they'll redesign the switch.
Yep.
And they'll make it waterproof.
Or shield it or, do something with it. Yeah.
Exactly. 602-508-0960 if you want to talk about your car. Give us the symptoms. 602-508-0960. My name's Mark Salem. Sitting next to me is Alan Salem. We'll give you a hand in just a minute. Welcome back, everybody. Let's see, 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock, we're here till noon. If you have a car question or a car problem, or you have even a car story, you can give us a call, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. My name is Mark Salem. Alan's sitting next to me, and we work on cars for a living. So we're not here to sell you on our services. We're here to give you good guidance and stuff. I had a lady the other day, and I'm going to remind me to do Thompson's real quick. Mm-hmm. I had a lady the other day that it was customers of ours, and she had virtually a brand new car, and somebody knocked the left front corner clean off of it. She was involved in an accident. So she called me. She was terribly upset, and they were going to have to pull the motor on this Subaru. So what does that tell you? What are they going to replace if they're pulling the motor on the Subaru?
The cradle?
That's exactly right. So there's a square piece of metal underneath most front-wheel drives that supports the engine and the transmission. So that cradle underneath the car that supports the engine, it had to have been damaged. So what you do is you set the car, you take the front wheels off, you take the axles off, you unbolt everything with the motor and the transmission, then you literally raise the car off of the cradle. Now, the cradle is being supported by four jack stands or, you know, four pieces of wood or whatever you want. So you raise the car off of it, and then the engine and the transmission are sitting right there. So then what you do is you pick up you unbolt the engine and transmission from the cradle, and you move it to the new cradle, and you set it down and bolt it up. Then you slide the new cradle, you drop the car back down on top of it, put it all together. So she was really concerned. It scared her. Now, on a 1 to 10 scale, for a senior tech to do that work, what's the number, 1 through 10, with 10 being the most difficult task we do? What was your being there?
I would say 3 to 5.
Okay, I gave her a 6.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, and that's okay that we differ.
It's actually a much easier, more efficient way to remove engines, remove transmissions.
But the reason why I said 6 is because we have to disconnect so much, and that's where the problem is we forget to hook up a vacuum line, we forget to hook up a wire harness, and we make a mistake.
It's time-consuming, but it's not difficult.
Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, I said to her, let's take one thing at a time. She also said it was a $12,000 repair, which isn't much in today's world. And she kind of wanted the insurance company to total the car so she gets a new one. But in reality, they said no because they could fix it and the car would still have value. So at the end of the day, I said to her, I want you to drive it for 2 weeks. I want you to pay attention to wind noise and vibrations, and it pulls to the left, it pulls to the right, it pulls to the right when you accelerate hard. Make sure that it brakes in a straight line, that the pedal feels the same way. Go highway speeds and go slow and make sure there's no vibrations. I gave her all of that. I even told her to pull up and keep her garage door closed at night and pull up about 10 feet and do what?
Check the lights.
Check the headlights.
Headlights, make sure they're aimed properly?
Exactly, because we want them to be level, and we don't want the right one to be high and the left one to be low. But we also want to get out of the car and kind of step to the back corners and make sure the headlights are kind of right down the sides of the car.
Because most of them aren't adjustable.
Yeah.
Cornell is your first caller. Cornell.
Go ahead. You can't have a joke on the radio without telling them the whole joke.
The other day I was, we were up at the cabin and I was adjusting my headlights on my truck. And he says, well, did you adjust them side to side? I said, there's no adjustment on these Dodges side to side. It's only up and down. Oh, BS. That's not true. This and that. I said, you want to bet? Yeah, I'll bet you. All right, let's bet $100. So we walked over his truck. He searched for 10 hours trying to figure out where the horizon adjustment was. And he still hasn't found it, and I still haven't been paid. So whenever he does.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. The horizon is left and right.
Yeah.
And vertical is top and bottom. They all have a top to bottom,
yeah.
But they don't have a vertical or a horizon left to right.
Yeah, our particular truck does. There are vehicles that do, but I'm increasingly seeing more and more that don't.
Okay. All right, let's take Cameron. Cameron, good morning to you. How can we help
you? It's Cornell.
Cornell, I'm sorry.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I do have a 98 Toyota RAV4. And it has 280,000 miles.
Okay.
And the RPM stays high, 2,000, no matter cold or hot. And I went to different places. They checked. They changed the whatever they diagnosed. And they replaced the part, and nothing works.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of things that certainly we need to check. We need to check to make sure that the coolant sensor is telling the computer the right temperature. You see, if the coolant sensor is disconnected or the harness has been cut or the connection is bad, then the computer thinks that it's 30 below zero. And obviously, when it's that cold, the computer's going to raise the idle like the choke used to do in the 70s. So we need to make sure that the coolant sensor is reporting the right temperature and the coolant sensor is talking to the computer. So we go through the computer and we can actually see what the coolant sensor is saying. Then we need to clean the throttle blades, we need to check the idle air control motor, and we need to make sure that the mass airflow sensor isn't getting any air that it shouldn't. Because the mass airflow sensor is supposed to measure all the air that's going into the engine, into the lungs of the engine. If it sees 5, then it sees 5. But if it sees 10, that means it's going to idle the motor up because it thinks now we're accelerating. So there's so many different things that have to happen. I'm guessing you probably didn't go to a full-service shop because there's no excuse why a full-service shop wouldn't be able to handle this, especially the fact that it's a 98, so it's 10 years old. Perhaps maybe you went to a shop that does brake work or transmission work or something like that, but I think you'd be better served. What part of town do you live in?
West Side, and I went to 27th Avenue and Indian School to, I can't remember his name, and they diagnosed, and there were 3-4 different things with whatever is being changed and nothing worked.
Okay, did you go to 38th Avenue in Indian School? Or 27th Avenue in Indian
27,
School.
The one you recommend?
No, he's at 38th Avenue.
Right. I'm sorry. He's 38.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. See, sometimes what happens is and you have 280,000 miles on this car. So
yes.
you literally have been around the world almost 12 times.
Yes.
So you know, if we have to clean the throttle blades, then that just has to be done. If we have to clean the mass airflow sensor, that has to be done. So when you get all this false information going into the computer, you got to start somewhere. This is what you do. You look him in the eye and you say, okay, I don't want this to be a never-ending line of parts. So what do you want to do first, second, and third, and how much is that going to cost me, and what's our chances of that making a difference for the better? So he says, after I get everything cleaned up, then I have to go in and readjust three adjustments to get this to idle right. And then you say, fine. So that's kind of what has to happen, okay?
And the other problem, I'm sorry, the other problem that I have, when I turn the key, the engine light doesn't come out. That's another problem.
Okay, so the check engine light doesn't come on when you turn the key on, but you don't start the car.
Right.
Did you just buy that car, or have you had it for 200?
No, I've been having it since 100,000 miles.
Okay, well, we need to fix that, too. We need to get the check engine light to come on when you turn the key on, but not when you start the car for about 3 seconds.
Right.
So I don't know if the bulbs burn out. I don't know if somebody disconnected it. I don't know if the computer is talking to the dashboard, but that's something that has to be done. But we can kind of go around that, Cornell, because we can plug into the computer and we can say, hey, you got any codes stored? And the computer goes, yeah, I got 27. Or the computer says, no, I don't have any. Well, if it has any, none, then we know that I don't care what the check engine light says. But if it says I got 5 or 27, then you go, well, the reason why Cornell didn't address all those things is because he didn't know the check engine light wasn't telling him. So that's kind of what happens.
Okay, so my next thing is I'm going to bring it to you.
You can do that. You can do that.
Yeah.
I understand that you want to do that, but... How much money did you spend at Harker's?
It was over $100 for just diagnosis.
Okay.
And then the other part.
I would like very much if you would email me what he said he wanted to do after he diagnosed it.
Right.
I'd like to do that. Can you write down my email address?
What I'll do, I'll probably call you. I don't have anything with
okay.
me right now.
Okay.
But I'll. Okay.
Yeah, it's my email address is easy. It's mark@marksalem.com. So okay. M-A-R-K at Mark Salem. Salem spelled like the cigarette, S-A-L-E-M. If you'll send me, you know, I don't care about his diagnosis, but what did he say?
Mm-hmm.
Then I might call him and we might, like two doctors, talk about it, okay?
Right.
And then let's see what happens. I'd like to do that first. You honor me by asking to come to my shop, but let me help you first and let's make sure that that's the right decision, okay?
Appreciate it, sir.
Okay, thank you, Cornell.
Have a good day.
You bet. We'll be back talking about cars right after this. And we're back together. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing. Since 1970, Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing has been providing expert auto and light truck repair, maintenance services to their customers in Mesa. They're the only shop in Mesa that I have on my list of best car repair shops in Phoenix. They have ASC certified technicians at Thompson's Auto Repair, and they're at Stapley. They're actually on Main Street just east of Stapley. Main Street just east of Stapley. Brian and Thelma own and operate Thompson's Auto Repair. I think they're third generation Thompsons, and they're good people. They're exactly the kind of people I say they are. When you meet them, you'll meet both of them, and you'll say to yourself, Mark Salem was right. They are really good, honest people. So if you live in Mason, you don't have a car repair shop, I think I'd try Thompson's Auto Repair. They're on Main Street just east of Stapley. Wayne, good morning to you. How can we help you this morning?
Hello.
Hello.
I have a 09 Chrysler Town & Country 4-liter engine, and the thing misses intermittently. Anyway, the computer says it's cylinder number 6, and I talked to you about this 3 or 4 months ago. You said drive it until it's more frequent instead of intermittent. I've been driving it, and it's come on once in the last 3 months. It bugs me.
How often does it miss?
I'm sorry?
I need you to get closer to the phone because we're getting a pretty good echo out of you.
Okay, let me take you off speakerphone.
Okay. Oh, perfect, perfect, perfect.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, how often do you feel the miss versus how often does the light come on?
Okay. I was going to say thank you for that question because I should have said to you, the frequency of the light coming on is it came on like 3 or 4 months ago. I had it checked by a mechanic. He told me what the computer said, and recommended the same thing you did. We'll drive it because we can't get it to replicate, because by the time I got it to the shop, it wasn't doing, you know, the missing.
Okay.
So anyway, he says, it's cylinder number 6. That's what the computer's telling us, but it's not missing now. We have to drive it until we can, you know, get it to miss and then track the thing down. So I've been driving it. The light was off until about maybe 3 weeks ago, and it came on. It missed, and now it's not missing again. It was missing for maybe, you know, a day.
Okay, I have some middle ground here for you. The question is it the coil, the wire, or the spark plug? So I think what I would do if I were you is I would switch number 6 with number 2 and number 2 with number 6 on the spark plugs. Just move new, and then if the code comes back and it still says it's number 6, then I would want you to switch the coil and the spark plug wire, and I want you to take the coil and plug wire off 6 and move it to 2 and move 2s to 6.
Okay.
And at that particular point, if the problem still comes up to number 6, we've eliminated the spark plug, the wire, and the coil. So now we're going to look and see what else is tied to cylinder 6. And, oh, the EGR valve is. So the EGR gets vacuum off of number 6. Huh, but if the EGR held open, it would cause a lean condition, which would cause a miss. And the computer would interpret that as a miss, but in reality, it's just we're shoving too much air into the motor. So why don't I do this? Why don't I take the vacuum line off of the EGR, and I know that I'll have an EGR code, but I don't care. So I'll take the vacuum line off, I'll plug the EGR vacuum line, and then I'll have you drive it for 30 days, and you come back and say, no problems, never missed, everything was fine. And I say, okay, fine. I plug the EGR back in, and you say, a week later, boom, it's back on. And I feel the miss. Well, it's at that point I'm going to say to you, all righty, Wayne, we need to pull that EGR valve off and check it out, maybe clean it, or maybe replace it, because we've already identified that it's the cause of your problem. That's a hypothesis that typically happens, although I don't want you to go replace the EGR valve. All right?
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you, buddy. Thank you very much. Carlos, you're up next. Carlos, how can we help you?
I've got an 08 GMC pickup with a 5.3-liter V8.
Okay.
And it's burning oil. I have to add probably a quart in between oil changes. It's got 190,000 miles on it.
Yeah, I want to tell you that General Motors says that a quart every 1,500 to 2,000 miles is acceptable, even for new engines. So if you're doing a 3,000-mile oil change and you're a quart low, I'm here to tell you that if that was my truck, I wouldn't care.
Okay, my only concern is, and I don't know if it's an issue or not, but recently I had to put catalytic converters on it, and I don't know if the oil burning is the reason for that.
That's a good question, but are you seeing any blue smoke at all, ever?
Yes, and I can't tell you how often, just on it. Some occasion I'll happen to catch a glimpse in the rear view and see a puff of smoke out the back.
Okay, because let me tell you, that the catalytic converters glow bright red, and their job is to consume things that come through them. They won't be hot first thing in the morning, so you're more likely to see blue smoke within the first 5, 6, 7, 10 minutes of driving. After that, you're not going to see blue smoke coming out of the tailpipe. So, because the oil is going to be consumed in the tailpipe and there's no blue smoke left. But at 190,000 miles, you should have put cats on this.
I got to tell you.
Okay. Well,
go ahead.
The fact that that truck, that you haven't done anything with the cam or lifters or anything like that is amazing to me in itself.
Because we're running across camshafts that have got no lobe, we got an engine miss, we don't have any rocker assemblies, and you have to pull the camshaft out, replace all the lifters, and the bill is typically?
5 to 10, depending.
5 to 10,000.
Yes, 5 to 10,000.
Okay, but if we don't have to do major motor work, but we have to take a lot off to get to the camshaft, which is the whole front of the engine, the whole front of the truck.
I mean, it could be as low as 35, but they're more close to the 5 to 7, probably.
Okay, so in your particular case, what kind of oil are you using? What brand and what weight?
I used Valvoline, I used 530, and I'm using full synthetic.
Okay, I would get away from that. I would go to probably a 2050 or a straight 30 weight, and I'd go to a conventional oil, because you're changing it every 3,000, yes?
Yes.
Okay, that's a waste of synthetic, because synthetic goes from 8 to 10. So let's get the heck away from synthetic, let's go to a 30 weight, let's go to a 3,000 mile oil change, and then let's see where we're at. Because
okay.
If we can get that, and really, I'm saying to you, let's get the oil consumption under control, but I'm really telling you, that is perfectly normal.
Okay.
So
the part of my concern was past history. I had called you on this truck probably a year ago, and you diagnosed, quite accurately, I might say, an oil seal that had gone bad. And it was a, $20 part, $800 repair.
Yeah.
The truck's four-wheel drive. They had to pull the whole bottom of the truck out to be able to get to the part.
Yeah.
And I was having a low oil pressure reading.
Yeah. It's
and
the pickup tube. For everybody else, it's the pickup tube. Has an O-ring connection. When the O-ring connection goes bad, then we start sucking air instead of oil, and then we have low oil pressure. And the repairs to pull the oil pan off and replace this stupid $8 O-ring. But in order to get there, especially with a four-wheel drive, it costs you an arm and a leg to get there.
I didn't know. Exactly. And they... I took it to Action Auto on Deer Valley. They did a great job.
Good.
Charged me almost to the dollar what you said it would cost. And anyway, I didn't know from running, from driving the truck with low oil pressure if that created a problem, if this is just typical of this motor,
no,
how much life. I want to drive this truck for a while, and I'm hoping, I don't know if these motors last.
Let me help you with this. The issue is if you're consuming oil at an abnormal rate, within the first 6 to 8 months, you're going to foul a spark plug. If you haven't fouled a spark plug, then you're home free. And if you don't foul a spark plug in the next 6 months, you're home free. So
great.
That's the beginning of the end. When you foul a spark plug, we're on life support. You got a tough decision to make. You going to put a motor in this at the appropriate time, or are you going to get
Two
rid
minutes.
Of it? Or are you just going to drive it and swap the spark plugs out? Those are your choices. So I got to run, but thank you very much for your kind words. And if I diagnose that right, it's only because my staff is so doggone good. they really do a good job and find those things out. And, of course, we share that information with you guys. And we're not afraid of telling you how to get your car fixed. This show has nothing to do with feathering our pockets with your money. It has to do with helping everybody understand about cars. S&S Auto Service is a great place. They have three stores, Peoria, Sunrise, and Goodyear. They offer a comprehensive line of tires and many different brands in many different sizes. It's important to know that. Many different brands in your size. So when you go there, you can say, how much do I write my check for before I leave home for your good, better, best? And they'll give you that information. So again, they're in the area of Peoria, Sunrise, and Goodyear. They have ATV tires. They got trailer tires, commercial tires, construction tires, golf cart equipment, farm equipment. But they've also got sport utility vehicles, pickup trucks, and cars. Just about everything you could possibly ask a tire for, they have. And I'm willing to bet you a dollar that they've even got a wheelbarrow tire, because that's the kind of warehouse they are. So that's S&S Tire, again, Peoria, Sunrise, and Goodyear, a great place to go. We're going to be back in just a few minutes, and we're going to continue talking about cars. You're welcome to call us. The lines are wide open. Gil is running the show for us. He's running the board. And that number is 602-508-0960. The lines are wide open. That means that about 3 minutes after, we're going to take our first call. And right now it's 58 minutes, so it's 2 minutes till. So in about 4 or 5 minutes, we're going to get back here and we're going to talk about cars. Again, 602-508-0960. My name is Mark Salem. Every Saturday we're here from 10 to noon talking about car repair. We'll be right back.
This was
full hour of automotive mayhem with the real car guy, master technician Mark Salem, where the only two things we can't fix is a broken heart and the crack of dawn. To talk to Mark, call 602-508-0960. That's 602-508-0960. Now, once again, here's Mark.
Welcome back, everybody. I know this is hard to believe, but I made a mistake. When I was talking about S&S tires, I have a bad habit of saying Peoria, Sunrise, and Goodyear.
It's my understanding you've done that multiple weeks.
You know, I'm willing to admit I made a mistake, and you have to rub it in.
Yeah.
You don't want to cross that bridge.
Well, it doesn't happen very often.
Because, okay.
No, not the mistakes.
Oh, okay.
The admission
Of mistakes. Well, I'm going to clean up my mistake, and then we'll talk about some of yours.
Okay.
Okay. Peoria, Surprise, and Goodyear is where S&S Tire is. Peoria, Surprise, and Goodyear. Speaking of mistakes, there was a Ford truck that we did some work on, and this Ford truck, we ended up pulling the engine out not once, not twice, not three times, but four times. And so, folks, let me explain to you. Every time the engine comes in and out, it's like, what is it, $3,000?
Probably.
$3,000. And so this was a truck that I said to him, don't take this truck in, because I could tell that this truck was going to eat our lunch, but yet we took it in anyway. Has the story gone straight so far?
Yeah, sure it is.
So did we learn from that?
Oh, there's no question.
Yeah.
lots of things, yes.
But in reality, the only reason I had that thought is because I walked in those shoes.
Yeah.
There's been many times I knew better. I had a call not too long ago about somebody with an intermittent windshield wiper, and it didn't take long for me to determine I didn't want nothing to do with that car.
Right.
When they start the story out that they've been to 400 places and nobody can fix it and blah, 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 and I'm not paying you. As a matter of fact, that lady that came in not too long ago at the front counter.
Right.
The conversation sounded something like this. Correct me if I'm wrong. It's, I want you to fix my car, and I'll pay you after I know you fixed it. And that I filed Better Business Bureau complaints on all the other shops, and she's really aggravated about her car. But
yes.
This is the first time we've seen it.
Yes.
So your sister, Andy, says, ma'am, your parameters don't fit within ours. We don't have that kind of, yeah, we'll fix your car, and at the end of 6 months, if we fixed it, you come and pay us, and if at the end of 6 months we didn't fix it, then you don't have to pay us. We don't have that in our menu.
She wanted a lifetime guarantee is what she wanted.
Okay. Well, we don't have either one of those.
No.
So
no.
It's just kind of, there are some times you just have to
punt.
Well, and hopefully you learned you know, when to punt.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure, and you've been with the family business for 20 years?
Yeah.
22 years.
Yeah, 20 years, yeah.
So in a position of authority the last, what, 8 months, 9 months? I'm just kidding you.
Depends on what you classify authority as.
Well, you know, I tell everybody you work for your sister.
I do work for my sister.
But younger sister. I throw
sister.
That in. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You work for your younger
but there's
sister.
There's plenty of times that she needs her big brother, too, though.
But really?
You know,
okay.
Have to flex a little muscle, you know what I mean?
Oh, gosh almighty. All right, let's go to the phones. Roger, good morning to you. Thanks for holding. How can we help you?
Two quick questions. First one is, with these newer transmissions, and if you go back to the 60s, we used to call automatic transmission slush box.
Yes.
When we put an older vehicle like that in the 60s and 70s into park, it was always my understanding that a rod would go down through the transmission and lock the transmission. Is that correct or am I wrong?
Well, we are going to lock the transmission when it's in park, providing that the shifter linkage is firmly attached to the shifter, the shaft that comes out of the transmission, and that the parking pawl and all of its stuff is still attached and working appropriately. And the parking pawl is that part that kind of ratchets if you try to put it in park when you're still doing a mile an hour. There's that ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. So, but you are right, no matter whether it's new or old, when you put it in park, that vehicle should not move in spite of the fact that it's on a 45% incline, I should say.
So a rod, even in a newer vehicle, still goes down through the transmission and locks it.
Well, no, I don't agree that there's some kind of a rod that locks the transmission. The shift shifter is going to put it where there's a variety of things that happen that lock the front and the back. So we have to lock the front and we have to lock the back. The back keeps the tires from moving and the front keeps the engine, and it puts the transmission in neutral so the engine can start and run, but it doesn't, it's not affected the back wheels. So as you put it in drive, then we send power to the back wheel. So you're there's no rod that breaks it. It's, we're going to divide the transmission in half, and half of it's going to be attached to the engine, and half of it's going to be attached to the rear wheels or the front wheels, depending on if it's, it's front wheel drive.
All right. Second question. I'm on 17. This is hypothetical.
Okay.
And there's a terrible accident, and there's a 2-hour backup, and it's 110 degrees up.
Okay.
So is it bad for the vehicle to sit there with the AC on idling for a length of time?
No, as long as you, I mean, I think that you should watch your temperature gauge, and if it gets over 3/4, I think you should bring the RPMs up to about 1,200, 1,300. That'll cool the engine down. And okay. I think that you should have maximum. You should go maximum, which is recirculatory in the car. It doesn't do any good to suck outside air because it's 110, so what sense would that make? So maximum recirculation, keep your fan on high. Even if you get a little cold, drop your window down. We want to keep the cabin cool. Watch your temperature gauge, and if you have to sit there for an hour or 2 hours, then your car should be capable of doing it, unless, of course, it's a Ford, and I'm not quite sure about those.
Well, I guess telling you that I know that they used to call them slush boxes gives you an idea how old I am.
No, you're right.
You don't hear that term anymore.
Well, a slush box, instead of with a four-speed, you went, it was a quick shift, like snapping a carrot, boom. A slush box went, you know, that's where it came from. That was what a slush box was. The four speeds and they would shift with the snap of a carrot, and the slush boxes, they didn't do that good. But the ones of today do that. If you throttle them up hard enough, they'll bark the tires on you. So it's different today. But thank you, Roger. Thank you very much. All righty. Ken, you're up next. How can I help you, Ken?
Mark, I hope you're having a good day. We have an 014 Explorer. The right backup light is out, and the manual indicates that you just remove a couple of bolts or nuts, and the taillight comes out, and you can have access to them. However, it's got those little plastic caps on to get at them, and I don't want to go digging them out of there. What's the way to get those plastic caps out without damaging?
Well, most of the time we'll use like a sturdy knife. We're not going to use anything that's real thick.
We typically use, they make a lot of them door panels as well.
Right.
And there's plastic, they're called panel removers. And I know that they have a set of four of them at, like at Harbor Freight. That's what we typically use, something plastic that will let us leverage underneath those and pop them up without damaging them.
And he brings up a good point. I want you to think about a set of flat tweezers, and you're going to slide them under both sides of those little plastic, and then you're just going to pop them up. Now, if you were to take two butter knives and put them side by side and put them underneath that, and then if you had about an inch of the butter knife past the button and you lift it up on the handles, that would probably pop that little plug out for you nicely. Now, when you put it back in, it would be okay if you just dabbed a little grease on it or just a drop of engine oil on it or some silicone, because it'll make it easier for the next guy to get them out.
Okay. Right. I have Harbor Freight that's just down the road. Should I know you gave me alternatives, but should I go down and get that tool, or just
it looks like a fork, but it's not like the fork you eat with, because it's a V, and it's very flat, and the mouth on it has got to be a quarter of an inch or more wide.
Yeah, it starts about a quarter of an inch, and then it like V's down to where they touch.
Right, and so you're going to just slide that underneath there, and then the end of it's going to have about a 45-degree angle on it, so you're going to rock the handle down, and poof, it's going to pop those right out.
And like I said, they come in a set of four. There's a lot of other uses for them as well, but they're called panel retainer removers or panel removers. I would go get you a set of those.
Okay. Good advice. Thank you very much.
You bet you can. Thank you very much. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. You know, folks, those of you that come in at 11, we're here at 10 o'clock in the morning. We're here and live, and so it's a little slow at 10 o'clock, but people say, oh, I listen to your show, and I really enjoy it. And I say, well, you know, what hour do you check in on?
And they go, 2 minutes, and Randy is your next caller.
And they said, well, I usually check in when you start the show at 11. So we just gently remind everybody that we're here for 2 hours from 10 to 12. And you can usually get in a lot easier the first hour than the second hour. Randy, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Yes, Mark. I have a Ford F-250 7.3 with 244,000 miles on it. The AC compressor let go. So I'm going to rebuild the AC system, and I'm going to replace the accumulator, the orifice tube, flush the manifold. I got a question on, is it all right to flush the condenser?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're going to want to you're going to have to disconnect both ends, as you well imagine, and you're going to have to put a rag over one side and use some compressed air at about 40 or 50 pounds, not much. And then you put a rag over the other end, and you want to see what comes out.
1 minute.
And if there's a bunch of trash comes out and it's all black tar, then you really ought to replace the condenser. Now, we use nitrogen, and we know that the condenser is capable of 300 or 400 pounds, but you're not going to find that anywhere from an air compressor. So we use nitrogen because nitrogen doesn't create water, and we blow out condensers and evaporators with that. If you're going to take the compressor off and do all the work you're talking about, then blow everything out. But I like the idea you're going to
plan on doing.
Yeah, orifice tube, accumulator, and make sure you follow the direction on the accumulator because they're going to want you to put an ounce or two of refrigerant oil in the accumulator because the old one had some refrigerant oil.
Yes, I did that 2 years ago when one of the manifold lines had a leak in it, so I replaced the accumulator, put the oil in it, and now the compressor did not.
Has gone to Ford Heaven. We say con. Another thing you're going to do, if you're going to blow out the accumulator or the condenser and the evaporator, you've got to add a little ounce of oil to each one of those because you're going to blow a lot of the oil out.
Right.
So we need, and that's an R12 system, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, because 12 needs to circulate
that. No, it's 134. It's 134.
Then it may not be nearly as important. And one last thing. Make sure you read the directions on the compressor because it's going to tell you a process, how you drain the old one, and you measure the old one in ounces, and then it tells you, based on what the old one has, this is how much to put in the new one. Now, the new one may come with 6 ounces, but by the time you do the formula, it only wants 3 ounces in there. You have to drain 3 ounces out. If you don't, then you've oversaturated the system with oil, and you're going to pay a big price because you're going to work on that system for the rest of your life. So make sure you follow the directions on the compressor with respect to how much oil you drain out of the old one, and that'll tell you how much you put in the new one. Okay?
All right. I have one quick question.
Okay.
Went to emissions the other day for my truck, and I have stage 2 injectors and a chip. And the guy goes, hey, do you have a chip on this? And I told him, no, I don't, but I do. Because I can't. My truck doesn't run without a chip with stage 2 injectors.
Okay.
It will run. Just run really rough. Have you heard of this coming down the emissions? Are they going to make us hide the chips and stuff like that?
As long as your opacity, and that's the burnt carbon coming out of the tailpipe, is within standards, then nothing else matters.
And no check engine lights.
I don't have any of that, but will they tell me to take the chip out? Are they ever going to come and look at the PCM, see the slot chip in it?
All they're concerned about is what comes out of the tailpipe. How you got there is your business. So today they're only concerned without the tailpipe, and it's been that way since the early 70s. What comes out of the tailpipe? Alan's right, though. The check engine light is important.
The 99% of those people
could... They don't even look at that.
I know.
They don't even...
Did they plug in underneath your dash?
No.
Okay.
They don't plug in on a 2001.
Okay, so you're home free.
99% of those people couldn't find your PCM if I gave them $500. And I'm not kidding about that. As a matter of fact, after the break, I got a good story about that.
All right, we got to take a break. They're already mad at me. Is it Randy? Randy, stay there if you have any more questions. We'll be back right after this.
Raised up from under my hood.
Welcome back, everybody. I've got my grandson, Mark Jr., here. And he's I'm teaching him how to run the board, and he's doing a really good job. How old are you? Hold on a minute. Let me turn on your mic. How old are you?
Nine.
Oh, that's the wrong one. How about this one? How old
Nine.
Are you? Nine. Are you getting this down?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay. Well, at least you know what you turn off during the breaks.
Yeah,
you know
much.
Why you turn those off?
Yeah.
Because they can't hear us using bad words.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so we don't get in any trouble. So
yep.
That's why we turn off the speakers and we turn off the two microphones. And then Gil wants to talk to us. We can hear him talk to the speakers.
Yes, we
That's
can.
What happens. So I've been doing this a long time. And you know how many times I've been called to the principal's office?
Oh, man. I can't even imagine.
That's exactly right. That's the answer. You can't even imagine. This portion of Unethered is brought to you by Kurtz Auto Repair. We're going to be at Kurtz April 1st. He's going to be celebrating 30 years. So that's Saturday, April 1st from 10 to 12. We're going to do a live remote. And we're going to have an open house at Kurtz. You can meet Kurtz staff. You can see their facility. They're not working that day. But it's just a big party, and you're welcome to stop by. I'll be there, and there's a good chance I'll be there for a couple hours after the show answering questions, and I don't mind a bit. So that's Kurtz Automotive, I-17 and Bell, northeast corner. Okay, Randy was done, and we were talking about what you said, and let me clean up what you said, is the most of the people at the emission stations are simply not qualified to find the PCM.
Yeah.
If they were qualified to find the PCM, then if you and I looked at someone's PCM, looked at it, touched it, we would be incapable of knowing whether that software has been changed.
Yeah. So quick story. I have a really good customer. He comes in a week before last, and he's got a Jeep. It's a 2008 Jeep, and it's been they've had a Hemi installed,
heavily modified.
No. This isn't his.
Okay.
This is a different customer.
Okay,
and Rogo customer, long time. He comes in and he is just panicked. His face is white and he's panicked. Now, his Jeep it has a Hemi in it, but it also has all of the legal requirements to be met to pass emissions.
Okay.
It's passed emissions since 2008 when this thing was installed.
Okay.
He goes down to the emission station, and it fails.
Okay.
The kid there, the quote-unquote three-whiskered kid, says, oh, man, this thing's got a V8 in it. That's completely illegal. You're going to have to take that out. This thing will never pass emissions. They send him down to the Jefferson Street address.
Right.
He walks in and he talks to a manager. Oh, this thing, aftermarket engine, aftermarket programming. You're tricking the thing. You're lying to it. You're lying. You're stealing. You're cheating. You're this and that. Scares him. Gives him a letter from the federal government stating that this can't be done. Well, wait a minute. This has been passed emission since 2008. What's the difference? Oh, everything's new this year. Everything's new. He comes into me and he says, "What are we going to do?" And I says, okay, well, what happened? I look at his sheet. The check engine light's on.
Okay.
I said, we need to check this out and then...
Fix it. Because that's why he failed, not the tailpipes.
That's why he failed. We need to, how much is it going to be to put it... I said, whoa, you're getting way ahead of yourself. Eddie finds out that he had recently had a transmission replaced. They let the wires on the O2 sensors hit the exhaust, shorten out the O2 sensor.
Okay.
So we replace it. We reset the monitors. I put Luis in the thing. I send him down there. He drives up. Hey, how you doing, Mr. Luis? Brum, brum, brum. Here's your pass sheet. Have a nice day.
But the issue was first of all, this Jeep came with a little bitty motor, and somebody put in a giant, big, mountain-moving motor.
Yeah, but all legally.
I understand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I understand. I'm drawing the picture
for
our radio listeners. So we took this little four-cylinder out. We put this monster Hemi motor in there. We put all kinds of headers and exhaust and all this kind of stuff. But the fact of the matter is they were telling him it wouldn't pass because of all the modifications.
Right.
When in reality, it was because of the check engine light.
That's right.
So the check engine light was reporting that the computer didn't like it because it lost sight of the two O2 sensors.
Right.
So once you fix the wiring to the O2 sensors, then the O2 sensors are talking to the computer. The computer no longer turns on the check engine light. Therefore, he passes without any tailpipe test.
Correct.
They pull in, they plug in into the car, they see that there's no codes, and they just pass your butt out of there.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. I'm glad we got that squared away. Let's go to the phones. Robert, you're first. How can we help you?
Thank you, Mark. Always enjoy your program.
Thank you.
A 2003 Dodge Caravan,
with about 120,000 miles on it.
Okay.
And it will not start on the first time. It'll crank and crank, let it go, turn the key off, hit it the second time, takes off.
Okay.
It'll start the second time every time, but never on the first time.
Okay, I'll fix it for you.
Fix it.
If I fix it for you, then the next time the plate passes you at church, you'll double it, your tithe, right?
I promise.
Okay. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to turn the key on.
Okay.
And I want you to count to five and turn it off. No cranking, just on.
Okay.
And then second time, you'll hit the key, boom, starts right up. I don't want any cranking the first time. I just want the key on for 5 seconds, and here's what's the matter with it. You have three places you can lose fuel pressure overnight. We have a check valve in the tank, which is part of the fuel pump, and we have a fuel pressure regulator that can cause it to lose pressure, and we have a leaking injector that can cause it to lose pressure. So what's going on in your world is when you hit the key, the time that you crank it is not enough time, because if the computer's going to turn on the fuel pump, and the fuel pump's starting from zero, so it has to go from zero to 40. Otherwise, if everything was okay, the computer, the fuel pump would already have 40 in it after sitting all night long. So it doesn't have to do nothing. So the first time cranking it, you're bringing it from zero to 40. The second time, it starts up. So the guy has to figure out if the fuel pump, the fuel pump and the check valve is allowing the pressure to bleed back into the tank. He has to check the fuel pressure regulator, which is really easy. And then he's going to say to you, I need to know when you start this up first thing in the morning if there's any black puffs of smoke coming out of the tailpipe. That'll tell him that you've got a leaking injector. Now, at 120,000 miles, have you ever put a pump on that?
No.
Okay. I'll bet you a dollar against five that's what it's going to be.
Fuel pump?
Yeah, fuel pump. Part of the check valve is inside the fuel pump. So when the check valve doesn't seal, then you lose pressure overnight.
Okay.
So I think if you do my test, and if you go to your shop and say, this is what I did, and if I do this, I hold it, I just turn the key on, and I take my hand off of it, and I count to five, and I turn it off, and the second time I hit it, it starts. If they don't, I'm telling you, if you tell them that, you just saved yourself $100 worth of diagnostic time.
1 minute.
I'll put it in the hat.
All righty.
Put it in the plate.
Thank you, Mark. If it works, yep. Okay,
yep.
Kurt and Mark, you stay right here because I'm up against some time, and I'm going to take you the next. Kurt, I can get your question real quick. Let's do that. Kurt, how can I help you?
Yeah, I've got a torn CV boot on the left front.
Yes, sir.
And I was wondering if they say they got to take the whole axle off to replace that. Is it worthwhile to just have the right one replaced as well, since it's 14 years old vehicle and
okay? Now, are you talking about replacing both axles or both boots on the same axle, or are you thinking about the outer boot on the left and the outer boot on the right?
The outer boot.
Okay. All right. You stay right there because I have an answer. I just need a little bit more clarification. So when we come back, you'll be my first guy. And then, Mark, if you stay there, you'll be my second guy. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. We're going to do what we said. We're going to go straight to the phones. We're going to get with Kurt. Kurt, let me get this straight. We've got an outside boot on the driver's side or the passenger side?
Well, let me clarify. It's a 2003 Toyota 4Runner, 190,000 miles, obviously four-wheel drive full-time. They're saying they have to take the drive axle shaft off in order to replace the boot. I'm not sure. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, whether it's the inside or outside boot.
Okay. Well, I can tell you that we replace outside boots over the CV joint, which is, all it does is keep the grease against the joint. That's all it is. It's there to keep the grease and lubricate the joint. And it's true that we have to pull the drive axle out to do that. So, but I want to tell you something. We can do two or three outside boots before we do an inside boot on most cars, because the outside boot has to turn left and right and go up and down, where the inside boot basically has just an up and down motion, and it's very small compared to the outside boot, and it has absolutely no left turn, right turn. What's that word I'm looking for? Extension.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that 90% of the torn boots that we're doing, we found out that it's actually cheaper and easier to replace the entire axle.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I believe that what he just said is exactly what our thought process is. We can usually buy a rebuilt axle that has two brand new boots on it for less money than the boot and the labor to beat the axle apart, clean the joint, put a new boot on it, pack the joint, then band it, then reinstall it. So there is two different labors. Labor, pull it out and put the new one in. Okay, that's X amount of dollars. It's usually $100, $125 to yank an axle, somewhere around there. It could be less. Or you pull it out, you rebuild that whole joint, and then put it back in. So I'm telling you, you should explore that. I don't like the idea that someone's telling you that we should do the inner boot, because those of us that have been around a while with gray hair, we know that the inner boot can last two or three or four times the outer boot. So how many outer boots have you had on this side? Have you ever done one in 190,000?
No, I've never done any.
Okay, so here's the deal. You've gone straight for a long period of time.
Right.
And it's kind of like a knee joint. If you just sit down in a chair and you lift your knee and drop your knee and lift and drop your leg, that boot is just that. That's all the inside boot does it. But your ankle goes into a 300-degree circle, and that's what the outer boot does. Mm-hmm. So in your particular case, my suggestion is I want a number for a rebuilt axle installed. Thank you very much. That's what I would do.
Mm-hmm. Let's say that the outer boot needs replaced. Should I go ahead and replace the outer boot on the right side as well, because it's 13, 14 years old, there's present signs of dry rot or whatever?
I would squeeze it and look at it. And the boot has bellows, and the bellows has a 180-degree turn on them. Actually, it's more than 180. It's a U-shaped. So if you pinch the bellow and it's weather-cracked, then the answer is yes. But there is no benefit because there's no duplication of labor. We're going to pull one side out and either replace it or replace the boot. But to do the other side costs you twice as much money.
Okay.
So there's no duplication of labor here.
Okay.
Two separate things. All right.
Plus, you'll know when it goes bad because it's going to start slinging grease everywhere. So it's real easy to tell. Me personally, I wouldn't replace it until there's grease everywhere, and then at that point, I'd do it.
Okay.
And you'll see the grease on the ground in your driveway too. All righty.
I haven't seen that, but it is on the inside.
Okay.
Of the engine.
All righty. Well, good luck to you. Thank you very much, Mark. You're up next. How can I help you, Mark?
Yes, I have a 2003 Camry. Check engine light on, and the secondary converter has a pinhole in it. Is that my problem, most likely?
Well, what's the code say?
I haven't had it looked at yet.
Okay. Well, your 03 cam. We oftentimes put O2 sensors in front and behind the catalytic converter, and we're looking for differences in readings because the front side is a little heavy with fuel,
and
the back side should be clean. Sometimes we put a pressure sensor in front and behind the catalytic converter. And so I'm going to ask you this question. If the front shows tremendous pressure and the back one shows a whisper, what does that tell the computer?
Yeah, that's clogged.
Bingo. See, this is why we charge you $125 an hour labor.
Yeah, you're saying the secondary converter, you can actually see it leak.
Okay, but I don't think you have pressure sensors.
Okay.
I don't think you have pressure sensors. So the answer to your question is I don't know the answer.
Okay.
I would have to know what the code is, and it's not likely that a leak in the catalytic converter is going to cause something unless there's something screwed into the tailpipe behind the converter with a wire on it. Because if we're not monitoring what's coming out of the catalytic converter, there's no way the computer can know whether it's got a leak or whether it's got the whole back end blown off of it. So your 2003 is too doggone old to have all the pre- and post-sensors on a catalytic converter.
I know it had the small converter, then the secondary one after that. But
yeah, and I'm not quite sure. Are you sure that you have two cats on that?
Yeah. I got a really small one right at the beginning of the engine, then the
Have you got the V6 Camry? We lost him. We lost him. Okay, well, I'm kind of confused about two cats on it.
Some of them have it built in the manifold now.
I know, but then why would there be a secondary?
Well, if it's a six, it's going to Y-pipe into one. I don't know.
Okay, because usually if they're on the manifold, then we've got one on the left and one on the right, and then we go into the muffler or the resonator, and then we go out the back.
Yeah.
So I'm a little confused about, but nevertheless, it's okay. All righty, we're going to take a break. When we come back, the lines are wide open, so now's the time. If you have a car question, jump on the line, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back.
Litchfield Auto Repair would like to...
Sometimes it's the cover, sometimes... So involved with these characters. So here's the...
Most Friday nights, I can be found...
Welcome back, everybody. 44 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock. Mark Salem, Alan Salem, and actually young Mark Salem is sitting here next to me. You want to say hello to everybody? Wait a minute, let me push your button on. All right, say hello to everybody.
Hello.
What school do you go to?
Tarwater Elementary.
Tarwater Elementary.
Yes.
Any girlfriends yet?
No.
Okay, good. That's a good answer. Your dad and I, that's exactly the answer we want. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by IMM Auto Service. IMM has been around since 1972. They're in the northeast corner of Tempe, just south of the 202, just west of the 101. Why is IMM a shop that I know about? It's because they've bailed me out on the really tough cars like Saab, Fiat, and the Alfa Romeo, and Volvo. Anybody can do oil changes and brake jobs and tire rotations on those cars. Anybody can do cooling system repair, but it takes a special kind of equipment and a special tech to diagnose really tough problems when it comes to Volvo, Saab, Fiat, and Alfa Romeo, and that's what they do. But anything in your garage, Chevy, Ford, Chrysler, Honda, Toyota, they do that work as well. So if you have one of those really special cars, Volvo, Saab, Fiat, or Alfa Romeo, and any of the rest of them, IMM can take care of everything in your garage, where that isn't the case on most other shops if you have one of those strange cars in your garage. All right, let's go to the phones. Let's start with Rich. Rich, good morning. How can we help you?
Good morning. I've got a 1997 Honda Accord, and I'm going to be replacing the strut coil spring assembly.
Yes.
And also the control arm bushing and ball joint assembly.
Okay.
Now, what I want to do is I want to do one side at a time. So which one should I remove first, and then how do I replace them? Which one first, which one second?
Well, you're going to need special tools. And so you're going to raise the front end off the ground, and you're going to take the tire and wheel off. And it doesn't really make any difference which side you want to start on, drivers or passenger. It doesn't make any difference.
Uh-huh.
I would certainly put the car in a position where you can tow it out of there with the front suspension off of it just in case you get stuck. So you might want to back it into your garage just
right.
in case. Uh-huh. So on the right side, take the tire and wheel off, and then you have to have a spring compressor. So you'll put the spring compressor and compress the spring. That'll leave the whole assembly loose.
Okay, so. Hold on. I looked online, and I don't want to compress the spring. I want to take the whole thing out as a unit because I'm replacing it. The strut and the coil spring assembly came together.
Okay.
I'm going to replace it.
Okay. Well, I hope that you don't have to compress the spring after you put the lower control arm in, because the distance might be far greater than actually what you have, or actually less than what you have. The spring and the new strut may very well be longer than the old strut. So if you try to get it in there, then if you can't, then you're going to have a spring compressor to bring a couple of those coils together to make it fit before you can secure it. But on the lower control arms, you're going to have to know what you're doing to get those lower control arms off. You can unbolt everything, and you, are you going to replace the entire lower control arm, or are you just going to do the bushings?
No, it came with the control arm, bushing, and ball joint assembly all connected together.
Okay. Why are you doing this?
Well, because I don't want to pay $1,000 when I bought the parts for about $250.
Okay, but why are you doing this? Did somebody tell you
I've got 200,000 miles in the car, And when I hit a bump, it certainly sounds like it's bottoming out.
Okay.
And I look underneath, and I can see that the bushing on the control arm is smashed. I mean, it's gone.
Okay. If that's the case, then if you come to a slow, abrupt stop, the control arm, and when you apply the brakes, then the control arm moves. And then when you take off kind of hard, the control arm moves. So those are the typical symptoms when you have a lower control arm bushing bad, because this triangle gets to move forward and backward, which puts pressure on the two pivot points.
Gotcha.
Okay, so that's what you need to do first, is go drive this thing and have somebody diagnose it as a lower control arm bushing. Otherwise, you're just wasting your time. Of course, you got the parts already. But this isn't going to be easy on a 1, Alan, on a 1 to 10 scale.
Yeah, that's going to be difficult. This can be probably a 7.
Okay. And then there's, depending on where you're at, you're going to need an alignment afterwards.
Right.
And I just fear that you're going to have a tough time getting a brand new lower control arm with brand new bushings into the cradle, into the mounts. And I'm also kind of scared that you're going to have to take the entire mounting piece off of the strut tower, which is going to throw all the alignment off as well. So after you get it done, if you get it done, you're going to have to take it for an alignment. It's not like you can do a wait a week. You're going to have to take it to alignment relatively quickly.
Gotcha.
All righty.
Okay.
It's the best I got to offer you. Good luck, Rich. I admire you for taking this on. Why don't you call us back and tell us how you did someday?
I'll do that.
Okay. Thank you, Rich. Thank you. Alan, you're up next. How can I help you?
Hey, I have a Ford F-250 2003 Super Duty. I have all my running lights are out. Only my headlights don't come on. My flashes will... But my coaster dashboard is all out, too, and all. I checked the fuse and the switch, and everything seems to be fine.
Okay, well, the only place that I think you're missing a fuse. Because there is a fuse for the dash lights and the running lights, and the reason why they put the two of them together is when you're driving down the road and you lose your dash lights, virtually on every car I've ever seen, then you've lost the taillights, and that's the way the car tells you you've lost your taillights. It takes your dash lights with it. So what you need to get is a little 12-volt test light and ground the clip, turn the key on, start the car up, pull the headlights, and then you know how the back of the fuse has those two little metal tangs on it? So every single fuse, you touch left, touch right, the light should light on every fuse.
Yeah.
And on both sides.
It'll light on both sides.
Or not light on both sides if it's not being active.
No. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
You got three pot. Thank you.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't light on both sides, we don't have that circuit on.
Right.
If it lights on one side and not the other, then the fuse is blown. And if it lights on both sides, the fuse is fine.
Yeah.
So that's how it works. All righty?
Okay. So I must have missed a fuse when I was checking out.
Yeah, and you're going to need to look at your owner's manual, because that Ford can have two or three different panels in it. It can have one in the kick panel on the right, one in the kick panel on the left, and I've seen Ford put fuse panels inside the glove box and underneath the hood as well. So look in your owner's manual and find out where all the fuse panels are at.
That's right, because I'm mentioning about one in the passenger panel, and I thought, well, I saw one in the dash here. But no, there's probably one over there too, then.
Yeah. No, you're going to have to find the fuse, but if you lost your dash and your running lights or your park lights, you've got a fuse bad. Now, you could still have something that's going to pop the fuse, so if you got a 15 and it popped a 15, putting a 30 isn't going to fix it. You still have to track down the short, and if you put any trailer stuff on it lately, the short's probably going to be in the trailer harness, the trailer receptacle, the trailer connection. That's the most likely place you'll find it.
I know. Okay, I know. All right, yeah.
Okay.
Looks like it.
All righty. Well, good luck to you. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
You betcha. Running lights. I got to put that down so I know what he was talking about. We talked about Larry Harker's Auto, and the reason why Larry Harker's Auto is a great place for this reason. He's really good at diagnosis. Bob at Larry Harker's is one of those guys that you can say to him, you know, nobody else in the world can fix this. I've been around the world a couple of times, and nobody's fixed it. And I heard the other day that Mark Salem said that you can fix anything. And so that's why I'm here. That's kind of what we call waving the red flag in front of the bull. And that usually works. Now, sometimes it doesn't work, but for Bob, it does. He's really got the tenacity and the knowledge to track things down. He has pulled miracles numerous times for customers I've sent to him. He's at 38th Avenue and Indian School, by the way. He's just a good guy, and he knows what he's talking about. So if you have a problem and you're looking for a good diagnostician, then Harker's Automotive, 38th Avenue and Indian School, is certainly a place that you should try.
Tony is your next caller. Tony.
Tony, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Hey, thank you, Mark. I want to ask a question. It's not about my vehicle as much as what I've seen, you know, traveling north on the 101 at high speeds and even on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
These are like full-size trucks that are four-wheel drive, you know, anywhere from half ton to one ton, that have placed, you know, larger wheels and tires. And once they get up to speed, they hit a bump, the whole front end just starts shaking crazy back and forth. I think the term is called death wobble. And I, you know, was wondering, you know, if you can discuss and explain what causes this and why and what a person can do to fix this or prevent it.
Well, everybody calls it the death wobble, but there is a difference between a wobble and a death wobble. A lot of people have wobbles, and everybody calls it a death wobble, but there's a significant difference. However, you have to think about this. The two front tires are towed out, kind of a duck walk thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get going fast enough, one of them wants to point straight ahead, and the other doesn't. So you got one at 12 o'clock and one at 1 o'clock. So what they do is they take turns, and so they flip left, right, which causes the steering wheel to move. A death wobble you cannot control. It's there, and there's nothing you can do about it. This kind of a wobble you can control one of two ways. You can apply the brakes and slow down, and that almost always will stop the wobble. But a death wobble, it'll keep going for a long time, and there's really nothing you can do once that front end. Now, any looseness in the front end can cause a death wobble. So tie rod ends, upper ball joints, lower ball joints, lower control arms.
It only happens on straight axle pickups, so your Ford and your Dodges. Dodge pretty much got a handle on it in 2008. Prior to that, they had a ton of issues, and older Fords as well.
And the Dodges, it was the upper bushings in the track bar, and that would let
the steering. They upgraded the steering in 07.
Okay, but there was still a track bar issue, which comes from the frame down to the differential. And when those track bar bushings went out, then the front end would slide side to side.
Yeah, The updated steering is what we use to fix everything.
Okay. So the answer, Tony, is that, yes, what you're talking about, but we have plenty of trucks we've built and plenty of customers with big tires and wheels that don't have that problem.
Yes.
Many of those lift kits were put in or installed in somebody's garage or in somebody's barn, and they don't have the technology to know that they're installing a bad tie rod end or a bad truck bar bushing or a bad steering component.
So not setting the alignment up correctly.
Yeah.
Alignment has to do with it.
Now, after cleaning all those parts up, like you talked about, you know, the tie rod ends, you know, et cetera, does it help to put, you know, steering stabilizers on there?
No, it's not going to fix any kind of a wobble, whether it's a death wobble or a regular wobble. A steering stabilizer is not going to do that. The steering stabilizer is just going to give you a nicer feel of the steering as you go down the road.
Yeah, I get that a lot. Oh, I just need to replace my steering stabilizer. No, we need to figure out what is causing the death wobble. The steering stabilizer has nothing to do with it.
All right, Tony, I got to run, though. Thank you very much, Tony. Thank you for bringing that up, because it is a good point. Automatic Transmission Exchanges in Phoenix. He's been at 40th Street in Washington since 1968. Phil and his staff are not necessarily transmission dummies. They've been doing transmission diagnosis and repair for a very long time, 1968. So if you live in Phoenix and you need somebody to drive your car, Phil's open on Saturday for the first half of the day. And that's the time you can stop by, take a seasoned tech with you, take a ride, and be prepared to demonstrate the problem. That's what they need.
1 minute.
Then they're going to want to drive, and they're going to run it through some tests. They're going to manually shift it. They're going to go hard. They're going to go soft. They're going to feather the throttle. And they should be able to get pretty close in their diagnosis by them driving after you show them how to make it happen. So Automatic Transmission Exchange is on our list. They do good work, and they're at 40th Street in Washington. Folks, my email address is mark@marksalem.com. You're welcome to send me an email anytime you want. If you'll give me a phone number, I'll call you on a blocked line because I'm going to have some questions. Otherwise, you and I will spend lots of time typing emails back and forth. So just give me your phone number and be prepared for a number that says blocked phone number, whatever it says. And that's typically me, and my wife won't let me give out my number because she says that that way she can have some private, we can have some private time. So, Mark at MarkSalem.com. Thank you, Alan, for being here with us. Thank you, young Mark, for being here with us. And we'll see you next Saturday at 10 o'clock to noon every Saturday right here on 960.